So thank you for having me today. I will talk about how experience forms the brain, and we work with structural MRI in mice. So by the end of this, you will learn that within the day you've been here, your brain has actually changed its form, hopefully to the better. When you look at data from a human brain, what I'm showing here is cortical thickness data taken at the somatosensory cortex of humans. You see that there's a very nice development over age, from age 6 to 18. There's actually a decline in cortical thickness, probably as the somatosensory cortex is setting up, getting more efficient. But in addition to that decline, there's also a tremendous inter-individual variability at every given point. Now, some of that will be due to method errors, because the measure of cortical thickness is quite finicky, so some of it will be due to that. But what about the remaining inter-individual variability in the cortical thickness? And looking into that, I guess one of the first explanations one would think of would be genetics. So in a study done at the NIH, people were looking at monozygotic twins, dizygotic twins, and singletons to try to estimate the influence on cortical thickness by genetics, the shared environment, or unique environment, or pretty much whatever remains. And you see that quite a bit of the variability in cortical thickness across the cortex can be explained by genetics. A little bit can be explained by the shared environment, and most of it remains. Again, all the method error will be here, but there seems to be something that is different between brains, possibly due to the different experiences people had in their lives. And in a recent study I was lucky to collaborate with, looking at stutterers, we found a very interesting pattern over time. When you look at the stutter literature, and look especially, there's people having a nice theory about the motor language origin of stuttering. And what you see here is the left Broca's area, so it's thought to be the expressive language center in the brain. Various studies find that there is a difference in cortical thickness. Other studies find no difference in cortical thickness. Some find it thicker, some find it thinner. Looking at a very unique data set that ranges from 8 to over 40, we get to a very different answer, and that is that very early on, there is a difference in cortical thickness in the left Broca's area, in such that people who stutter, PWS, have a thinner cortex, but over time, this seems to develop differentially. It could be due to the same underlying cause that causes stuttering that it develops differently, or the fact that these subjects do stutter gives them a different experience, and therefore their left Broca's area develops differently over time.
How do you measure cortical thickness?
You take an anatomical MRI image, then you go through a number of steps to align it linearly with a model. Then you will go and extract the surfaces. So you take a sphere and slowly shrink that sphere onto the brain. And the first one you stop when you hit the boundary between gray matter and white matter, so you get a white matter surface. Then you take a second one, you stop at the gray matter, and then you take the distance between the two. So the distance between gray matter and white matter, orthogonal to the brain surface. That's how you measure cortical thickness. Yes. Oh, sorry. So yes, you do a segmented image in between, where you use the partial volume effect to classify everything in gray, white, and CSF. And then you shrink surfaces on it. Sorry. And so all of this gets me to my main story. The brain is plastic. So for the longest time, people thought or had the belief in the literature that the brain of an adult is more or less stable, except for the steady decline that comes with aging. And one of the, I guess, most famous studies that kind of challenged that view was the study out of London by Ms. McGuire, showing that London taxi drivers had a larger hippocampus than normal controls. And the idea is that the hippocampus is actually a very important structure for spatial navigation, and having to drive through London, which is not a grid city, so not everything goes north and south and east and west, it's actually quite a challenge. So if you want to be a successful taxi driver, you need quite a good hippocampus.
One of the things that they have to be able to navigate without a map or navigation system.
Before GPS, yes.
So you measure
it would be quite a challenge. Other interesting studies come up out of a group in Germany by Mr. Jurgansky and colleagues. He was looking at juggling. So he taught adults to juggle three balls. And he could show that within a week, you see a structural difference in the brain that is that areas that are there for visual, motor control, and coordination actually do increase. And they increase more with the people that are more proficient in juggling. And they decrease over time when they stop juggling. Again, the decrease is more pronounced in the people that get worse in juggling. Yes, they're all automatic measurements. So this was the VBM. So looking at the adult brain plasticity, what we wanted to look at is navigation, partially due to the study of Maguire. And to the other part, there's two very, very different ways that you can navigate in the world. And one is the stimulus response learning, and the other is the cognitive map. And these are the very famous people that go with that. So the one is, how do you find your way to Baldwin Street? You said you go out, you go left, you take the second set of lights, and you go right. That would be the first theory, stimulus response. You take a landmark and you do something. You turn left at the corner, wait for a Tim Hortons, go right. The other one is you actually have a true cognitive map in your head. This is where you need your hippocampus for. So I guess every one of you can close his eyes and know that the CN Tower is somewhere there-ish. You have in your head a map of where you are relative to other locations. Now, in a study done in humans by Ms. Bobo and McGill, she had 30 healthy subjects sit in an MRI and look at this virtual map. And this is a virtual radial arm maze. So you're placed in the center, and there's 8 arms to go down. 4 of them have a little present that you have to extract. And you have a joystick, and you navigate. Now, there's landmarks in this radial arm maze, and you always start at exactly the same position. There's two ways you can solve this. Either you count. You start here, and then you take the first one, 2 over, and 2 over. You find it that way, or you go by landmark. So I go to that tree, and there was also a little house somewhere over here. Unbeknownst to you, there will be a probe trial, and all the landmarks are removed. So now, if you were relying on the landmarks, you lost. If you were counting, you're perfectly all right. Now, when you look at the gray matter density, voxel-based morphometry analysis, you see that the subjects that have a larger more likelihood of having gray matter here in the hippocampus have more errors. So they were relying on a cognitive map, and they made errors as soon as they were lost, as the landmarks were disappeared. Now, the subjects that had more gray matter in their striatum, they did actually very well in the probe trial. And the subjects that had least amount of gray matter in the striatum did worse. And these are the two structures that are thought to be the basis of these different navigations, the hippocampus for cognitive map and the striatum for stimulus response learning. So, nicely enough, the two structures and their sizes distinguish very nicely between your choice in what learning you use to navigate. But the problem is cause and effect are obviously uncertain. So do I use my hippocampus because it is large and therefore use a cognitive map? Or is it larger because I used it so much? And the same goes for the taxi studies in London. Obviously, it could be that it's a selective process. All the taxi drivers that had a small hippocampus got lost and they stopped. And that's where mouse imaging comes in. There's a couple of advantages of using mice. The first one is there's basically no genetic variability. There's inbred mice strains for hundreds of years. You control their environment very nicely. They all grow up in their little cages. It makes it easier to do longitudinal studies because they age a lot quicker. You can force them to use one or the other training protocol, so you can force them to use a cognitive map or stimulus response learning. And also you can do genetic models or histological methods to study the underlying processes of what's actually happening in the brain. And so we do our studies using a 7T MRI that's sitting at the mouse imaging center. It has a 40 centimeter bore, and we can scan 16 independent samples at a time. And I'm going to talk about results coming from fixed brain imaging and later on some live imaging. So our fixed brain imaging is done in these three coils that we put in the scanner, and we get a 32 micrometer isotropic voxel after about 11 hours of imaging. So what happens is the brains are fixed. They stay 7 to 15 days in PDS. Have a little bit of contrast to enhance our signal, and then they're scanned. And a second set of images is acquired using a diffusion-weighted sequence, where we acquire six directions with 150 micrometer isotropic voxel, and that takes about 17 hours. Now, the acquired data for the anatomical images is then aligned to create an atlas. So we start with the native MRIs, then we will do a rigid body registration that gives us a rigid body average atlas. We then do a 12-parameter linear registration, and finally we will do a nonlinear fit. That's a complete iterative registration process with six generations altogether. And you end up with a very, very high resolution average image of your mice. So after all this, you have your individual MRIs, and you have the deformation fields that bring those MRIs into the common average space. And you can use those to do some mathematics on. So imagine a mouse 1 and a mouse 2 that are now in an average space. The cortex of mouse 1 had to shrink, and the cortex of mouse 2 had to increase in size to actually fit into that average. You can later use the maps of the deformations to get back to either the size of each voxel, or when you will align it together with an atlas that delineates the structures, you can actually get structure volumes, individual structure volumes out of this. And we do that using an atlas developed by Ms. Dorr that gives us 62 structures in each individual image and the volume for each mouse. And just to, show off a little, if you take three different mouse strains, the 129s, the black sixes, and CD1s, very common mouse strains. And you do a different atlas for each one of them. And then you compare the three. You actually see that the variability within each strain is much smaller than the variability between strains. And this method is actually able to pick it up. As Mark usually says, this is also one of the most expensive ways of distinguishing a black mouse from a white mouse. And also in many collaborations of the Mouse Imaging Center, there's now almost 600 scans of 32 different models where they were described with some behavioral mutations, could be very mild, and in 29 of them we found significant differences in brain structure. So now I will talk about bus and taxi mice for the rest of this. I think the best model of stimulus response learning is a bus. So a bus driver doesn't have to navigate, he goes from point to point. I go left at, I go right at, just a route. Or the best example of a cognitive map learning is the taxi mouse. And in the first study, what we used is the Morris water maze. In this maze, the mouse is placed in the water, and mice don't like water. They can't swim very well, they don't like it. And the surface of the water is opaque, usually using milk powder, for example. And there's a platform hidden slightly underneath the surface, and the mouse will obviously try to find it and stay there because it hates being in the water. Now there's four conditions altogether in this study. One is the spatial Morris water maze. This is the taxi mouse. This platform is always in the same location between trials, and there is distal landmarks placed around, you saw one here, placed around that water tank that a mouse can use to locate the platform. In the second one, this is the bus mouse. Now there is a curtain that takes away all distal cues, and the platform is at a different location at every single trial, but always there's a little flag on it. This is our bus mouse. It goes to the flag, all it has to do. There's an intermediate condition that has a flag on a platform that's always in the same location and has the distal cues, and the control mice. They don't do anything. They don't swim. And so there were 2.5 months old black six 129 hybrids they're supposed to be very good spatial learners. That's why they're chosen. They had 6 trials a day for 5 days. There were 6 mice per group. And after, so they were handled for a week. They had 1 week of training. They had another 10 days, and then the brains were fixed and scanned. And the idea about that is that using identical, genetically identical mice grown up in the same environment, they should be very, very similar to start with. So any difference we are going to find should be due to the treatment they had for a week. First of all, they learn very well. They get very quick in getting to the platform. They end up in the second range, and they go there, swimming as least as possible. And very nicely, it works out that the two conditions grow the appropriate structures. We instructed them well. So the mice, the spatial Morris water maze are the taxi mice. They grow the hippocampus compared to the non-spatial ones. And the mice that are bus mice grow their striatum compared to all the others. Interestingly enough, the mice that had both choices, they had a flag and the distal cues, seem to go by distal cues. They grow the hippocampus. And when you look at local changes using a voxel-based analysis, this is corrected using FDR for multiple comparisons. You see that in the spatial task, these are the taxi mice, you see growth mainly in the hippocampus. And when you look at the bus mice, it's in the striatum mainly. And now, using the advantages you have with mice to figure out what could be an underlying cause for the volume change you see, we did some histology. So we did a GAP43, which looks for axonal growth. This is just new N to label neurons. We have astrocytes. And then we have a double stain of new N and double cortin to look at young neurons, like neurogenesis. The only thing that turned out somewhat significant is that the amount of GAP43 seems to correlate nicely with the size of the voxels you found in the dentate, so the volume change, which leads us to believe that the volume differences we can see are possibly due to axonal or thus dendritic remodeling. Then we moved on and we used a different maze. The reason for that is simply that the room we have doesn't have plumbing, so water is out of the question. And the second is that mice don't like to swim, and it's very stressful to have them swimming. And the hippocampus is a structure involved in stress as well. So we try to get rid of that part and try to do a dry maze. This is called the Barnes maze. The mouse is placed on a platform that's elevated and highly lit, and there's 40 holes all around that it can go to. Only one of them has an escape box attached where it can actually escape from the brightly lit situation and have its peace. Mice don't like being exposed because it's dangerous. Now, in the two different conditions, in the taxi condition, there's a couple of landmarks around so the mouse can orient itself. And in the bus condition, there's a flag always attached to the hole where it should go. In the bus condition, the appropriate escape box will move around between trial. In the taxi condition, it will not. The same experimental outline to start with, so we wanted to prove that we can see the same changes in the Barnes maze using fixed imaging. So this time we used younger animals because we were planning to do in vivo imaging and they just got too big to go in the scanner. And so now 4 trials a day for 5 consecutive days. They lived another 10 days and then they were sacrificed and their brains extracted. And just to show you what it looks like. This is a mouse, first trial, first day. It hasn't learned anything yet. So it's placed in the center, it's brightly lit, and the mouse has no idea where to go, and it will move around, and eventually there's one of those holes has the escape hole. And it has no idea where to go, and eventually will move. And we will not see the entire movie, because it will take way too long. So there it goes, and then it would just sequentially go hole by hole by hole by hole to see where it should go. It has not learned anything yet. But now, this is a taxi mouse again. The very same mouse, now we're at day 5, trial 1. Here you see actually the basis of the landmarks that are around, and it has learned quite well. It looks around, it knows where it is, and there it goes. And will it go in? It goes in. And now the bus mouse, so we also place a curtain all around the maze to take away all distance cues. Here's the little flag that shows it where to go, and it hesitates a little, but then it will go. Successful learning. So within 5 days, they do learn. Now, if you look at the volumes, the taxi mice have a larger hippocampus compared to the bus mice. And if you look at the fractional anisotropy measure in the striatum, so the fractional anisotropy tells you how water diffuses in one direction or not. And the higher that is, the more structure you are supposed to have in that voxel you're looking at. So more structure that restricts the water flowing in all directions, like axons, like myelin. And you see that there's an increase in fractional anisotropy in the striatum in the bus mice as compared to the taxi mice, suggesting that there's something growing or going on. And the performance measured as difference between errors at day 1, day 5, correlates nicely with the hippocampus for the taxi mice and with the striatum for the bus mice. Now we come to the best part. So all of this was only the prelude. We wanted to move to live brain imaging because repeated measures is really what we wanted to get at. And so we moved from this imaging, from fixed brain, which gives a very high resolution, very high signal contrast, to live brain imaging with a quite different resolution. So now we are moving to 125 micron isotropic. And we can't scan them longer than about 3 hours because otherwise they start dying. And we can scan 7 live mice at a time. They're in this hive, they're placed in these tubes, they're actually lying on a little sled that takes their breathing and their heart rate. Isoflurane is supplied to them from the front, they breathe that, they're fixed there, and they stay there for about 4 hours and get scanned. And the experimental outline is similar, so we again have 8-week-old mice because otherwise they're too big to fit into these tubes. 6 trials a day this time, so they're scanned before training during the handling phase to get a baseline scan, and then they're repeatedly scanned during training and post-training. And right now we are up to day 15. And we added a noise at the mice because our mice were not motivated enough to actually do what we wanted them to do. So they weren't scared enough at all. And thus far we have 31 mice with altogether 89 scans. And we just scanned this afternoon. Now come the results. We start with the taxi mice. Now, on the left, so what we did, we tried to model what we would expect in the brain. And we think, thus far, that the best model should be a third-order polynomial, because we expect something to increase and then decrease again and level off somewhere. This will be tested, especially if we have more data. But so what we did thus far is we fitted a third-order polynomial to every single voxel in the brain of the mice per group. And then we put the intercept at 0 using the day 0 scan, or the 0 scan of all mice, and then tested the intercept at day 2 and at day 10. And the day 2 you see in blue, and the day 10 you would see in red. And these are T maps. They're not corrected and thresholded at T of 3.5. which is an uncorrected P of 0.005. Here you see this box is here. On the x-axis you see days. On the y-axis you see the relative voxel size of this voxel, and the training is outlined by this little box, so day 1 to day 5. So in the taxi mice we find that the entorhinal cortex increases in size very quickly, and then decreases again, going back to baseline. So at about day 1, it's already increased. It peaks at about day 3, and then it decreases again. As opposed to the CA3 field of the hippocampus, which increases much slower and peaks at day 10. There's not that much data out there, so probably day 10. And does not show anything, I guess, up to day 5. So very slow change. This arrangement would make sense because the entorhinal cortex is the cortex with all the visual inputs funneling into the hippocampus. So this is probably what they use to learn the maze and the spatial arrangement and the visual cues. But once they have a cognitive map which should reside in the hippocampus, they can rely on that to actually solve their problem. Interestingly enough, the striatum in the taxi mice decreases during the days of training. Could be an equilibrium problem. So usually, I forgot to mention that, usually all of us and the mice use both strategies at all times. This is artificial. We force them to do one or the other. So it could be that because they're forced to use the hippocampus, their striatum decreases in size slightly. And now we come to the bus mice. Again, very quick onset of some changes in the striatum and the right striatum, and some changes in the left striatum that come on much later, again at day 10. I have no idea why right and left. It's just the way it turned out. But again, you see a decrease in the CA3 field of the hippocampus in the bus mice in the first couple of days during training. So this is work in progress. We are acquiring more and more data. One thing we would like to do next is trying to test each voxel per group to see what model fits its behavior best, the linear one or a second order or third order polynomial. Also, we need more mice in the control group because they seem to behave oddly, but we don't have as many scans for them. But I'm pretty sure there's some promising results that we are going to work on and see what happens. So in conclusion, 5 days of learning is sufficient to cause measurable, subtle changes in brain shape. And you see actually that some changes are online at day one. So when I say day one in these scans, they were actually trained in the morning and scanned in the afternoon. So it's only a couple of hours in between. We are capable of detecting those changes in vivo MRI. And in theory, this could be a modality to do some functional imaging in mice. Whatever they use in the trials beforehand should be growing, and we should be able to detect that. The different brain areas show very different structural change patterns depending on training condition, and not only training condition but also time. And the volume differences are at least in part explained by axonal and dendritic remodeling, but not enough yet. There's still more to be done to figure out what they actually are. And things we would like to do next is get to the core of it and figure out what the cellular processes are that actually cause these structural plasticity. We would like to do some more with the time course of them and reverse learn these animals. So what happens to the mice that now have a large hippocampus when they're forced to use the striatum to solve the problem. And we would like to get a handle on their behavior a little better to see if we can distinguish between successful mice and less successful mice. So how much of a hippocampal change makes the mouse most successful? Is it the least? Is it the most? I guess it will be somewhere in between. And if we have enough data, look at the interactions and the time-dependent interactions of specific locations, so first the entorhinal, then the hippocampus. There should be more to it. And there's some disease processes that are associated with a marked decline in those structures. It would be interesting to see what happens if we grow the hippocampus first in an Alzheimer mouse model, for example, and see how the disease onset interacts with the previous volume increase. And I would like to close with acknowledging the people from the Mouse Imaging Center and the three people I was lucky to work with on this project.